louder than the other ones?
No. No.
Can we check our mics before we start?
Testing, testing.
Testing.
Test, test.
Test.
All right, you ready? All right, mics are on, and can you start the recording?
It's February 28, 2019, and I call the board study session of the Roland Unified School District Board of Education in order. It is now 4:30 p.m. Dr. Mitchell, will you please do roll call?
Carrie Chen.
Here.
Lynn Ebenkamp.
Here.
Angelina Pride is not present today. She had a family emergency. David Malkin.
Present.
And Donna Friedman.
Here.
All board members except for Angelina Pride are present.
Are there any changes or items to be pulled from the agenda?
None.
May I have a motion to adopt the agenda of the board study session of Thursday, February 28, 2019?
I move we adopt the agenda.
I second.
Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? No. Motion carries. Next, I will lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. Please stand up. Put your right hand over your heart. Next, Dr. Mitchell, are there any public comments this afternoon?
Yes, there are two.
Okay. Please note, the public is welcome to provide comment to the board. Remarks are limited to 3 minutes unless extended or limited by vote of the board. A maximum of 20 minutes unless extended by the board is allocated for each subject discussed. The Brown Act open meeting regulations under which the board must operate do not allow board members to comment on non-agenda items or information you may bring up that are not in the agenda. Additionally, no action can be taken. However, the board may give direction to staff following a comment. Roy Humphreys.
Okay, good day, and thank you for all the good things you do. And the subject today is core values, of which supposedly are safety, integrity, respect, responsibility, and accountability. As we have noticed, and your teacher staff have most recently, how the callous disregard for the safety of staff and students has gone on for very long, at least 10 years more that I got involved in the situation here, but it's gone much longer than that. But we must tip our hats. Today we're going to finally, in the 2019, address the situation. Thank you. As the point of respect, William Harrison, I think adequately took care of that. And remember, when you show disrespect for one, you show it for all. The other point is accountability. How is it possible that you can have accountability without transparency, which for Mr. Malkin is a buzzword for this district? And then we go to pages 79 and 80 of the audit report by Nigro & Nigro. And what do we have? A reoccurrence of the ASB accounting thing where they said inadequate documentation for the disbursement of funds. Doesn't that bring you back to the Macy's Day Parade situation? $20,000, and none of that would have been evident to anybody if it wasn't for somebody that you're looking at him right here. $20,000, and how long has that been? You should be outraged that that has been, and it's still going on right here, the inadequate. And if you go to the 111 credit cards given out, we just haven't got time for that. It should be carried on another situation to go over. And for Ms. Ebenkamp, this is horrendous, okay, and that to be addressed as such. And then we have the situation with the Oswald. How many we've got? Oh, I got plenty of time. With the Oswald situation, if you go to my website there, YouTube channel, you can see the Bond Oversight Committee where Jerry comes up and says, hey, Mr. Flores, why is it that Oswald got his youngest school in district? Well, that points out two things. That one is that these bond oversight people aren't not educated as to what the bond issues are. And two, that he failed to follow up. He said, Mr. Flores says, well, it's part of the bond issue. Well, how can it be part of the bond issue where $50,000 falls out of the sky all of a sudden after they got half a building with no toilets, and now they're going to get a whole work over $50 million and toilets around every corner. Inquiring minds want to know. Thank you.
Jay Lohman.
Thank you. To address matters at hand today, I want to start by just saying thank you. Thank you to the board, to Cabinet for having this much, much needed discussion. I don't know of another school district around who's taken the time to actually sit down and have a study session about this. So thank you. I will just leave us with a comment. We have a moral obligation to every single student we teach. Those are the students that are disruptive, the students that are acting out, absolutely have a moral obligation to reach and teach those students. I think at the same time, though, we have to remember we also have a moral obligation to the rest of those students in that classroom. We have to create a learning environment that all students can learn in. And so how do we deal with the situation where we might have one or two students that are disrupting and harming the educational environment for the rest of the students in the class? So it's just something to keep in mind. But really, I wanted to say thank you for really taking this topic on. So thank you.
Student behavior and discipline practices, procedures, and recommendations. I will turn it over to Dr. Mitchell at this time.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And so as the board has requested to do a study session looking at our student behavior and discipline practices, procedures, and recommendations, we have brought together a team of people to be able to share information and answer questions that the board has had. So Kevin Despard, our Director of Student Services, is going to lead us in our conversation. Contributing to the discussion will also be Maddie Zamora, our Assistant Superintendent of Education Services. We have Nick Garcia, who's the Assistant Principal at Giano, Celia Mungia, the principal at Rorimer, and we have Eleanor Purdy, who is the teacher on special assignment working with PBIS to add input if needed, Michael Tincup, our director of special education. We have Laura Lestrada, who is the coordinator of our Family Resource Center, Jason Garcia, principal at Oswalt Academy, and then we have June Sakaue, who is the principal at Blandford Elementary. And so we asked that these colleagues would come together to share information of questions that have come up previously, as well as to share some things that are happening at the school sites to give the board a full picture. And as we began planning and talking about things, we realized that it is impossible to do a full picture in a two-hour study session. And so we are going to do our best to stay within a reasonable time limit. But as questions come up and so forth, it may extend us a little bit, or we may need to come back and continue the conversation. So I just wanted you guys to know that we've tried to have a comprehensive report and information for you, but recognize that we were a little limited with time because there's so much to share. So that what's happening in our district. So at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Kevin.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mitchell. So I wanted to go ahead and start the presentation. First thing we're going to do is go over the objectives for this study session. We're going to start with going over the overview of trainings that have happened in the past few years, some current law changes that have happened in the past 7 or so years that have really affected student discipline, including educational code changes and placement options. We're going to then just do a quick overview of PBIS, which I know you know of, but we're just going to kind of remind and see how that all ties together. We're going to review how behaviors are reported and sample actions taken, and that's where we're going to have some input from the schools. We're going to also talk about how we address the more challenging student behaviors. We're going to talk about how the FRC and community supports also address student behaviors, and then we're going to finalize it with some next steps on the recommendations that we have going forward.
Let me just ask one question real quickly. It's a very large document. And do you want us to hold questions until you get to each end of each section or ask questions as you're going along?
I'm happy either way. If you want to ask questions as we interrupt, I mean, as we go by, that's fine.
A little easier. I would section? Suggest that.
Okay, as we
each. It works with the board only because your question is at the end, too. So
right.
It comes up in a later section that you go, I wish they would have asked
that. Right. So I wanted to give us a little piece here just to think about and something to consider. You know, one of the things that we have to consider when we're considering student behaviors is the importance of teaching students the behaviors expected in a school setting. We may often expect students to know how to behave in class, but that's not always the case. Just like some students need some interventions to to achieve academically, the same will go for student behaviors. So when students are struggling with the behaviors, it's our duty to help them and to help correct the behavior and help hopefully correct them going forward. And you know, sometimes we hear it might seem, you know, through board comments or through other pieces that the behavior is out of control at all school sites. And we know we have some challenging behaviors. In fact, we surveyed the schools and asked them to give us some names and some input about the most needy students when it comes to exhibiting the Tier 3 behaviors. And we asked all the principals, you know, we have 13,212, I believe it is. 302. I knew it was a little bit over 13,000. And it was reported back to us that we had 87 students district-wide that, you know, are exhibiting some extreme behaviors and who need those Tier 3 supports. Of course, those 87 students can affect a lot of what happens in the classrooms, can take up a lot of time in the classrooms, as well as by the administrators. But it is less than 1% of our students district-wide. And so we're going to talk about today how we support them and how we can better support them going forward. Next thing I want to do is just go over a little bit of the recent professional development. We wanted to go back just the past couple years just to see about the trainings that sites and administrators have specifically received on student discipline. So one of the big ones that we had started in October of 2017, where Vicente Bravo from Los Angeles County Office of Education came and presented to all the administrators in the district, all the principals and vice principals in the district about student behaviors and about some of the law changes that came into effect in the previous years that affected or that that must have changed that we have to kind of be conscious of when we're dealing with student behaviors. So following that, we had several principal meetings or professional learning sessions about addressing behavior in January 2018, March 2018, December 2018, January 2019, and February 2019. The school sites, following the sessions that we had from LACO and from the former Director of Student Services, the direction was to the school sites to present it to their staffs. So in the spring of 2018, each site district-wide presented some similar information to their sites. As you know, we've been on the PBIS journey for several years as well. That started in the 15-16 school year. As you know, we did the PBIS trainings over three cohorts. So the first cohort started in the 15-16 school year, and that's a three-year training. So last year was their third year of the training. The second cohort is now on their third year of the training this year. Next year, the last cohort will be on the third year of their training. So after next year, all cohorts will have gone through the training. Doesn't mean the PBIS stops or the training stops, because after you finish the 3 years of training, there are ongoing things that you see here listed as well, such as there's a PBIS community of practice, otherwise known as a COP, that teams come together and work and collaborate together on best practices and things that are working at different sites. Another thing that started this year is called the TIPS training, which stands for Team Initiated Problem Solving, where the schools that went through the first cohort were able to get some training on specifically using the PBIS structure to deal with specific problems or specific problems that were brought up through the PBIS process. We also started this year the Student Risk Screening Scale. It's a preventative survey that is given to the kids so we can help identify students who may be at risk for some behaviors. And then another thing that schools got was a school-wide information system training, otherwise known as SWIS, not the cheese, but the SWIS training, which is the data collection piece that PBIS uses, and you'll hear and see some of that later on today, and I think it was in your packets, about how the schools really use that data, and having some data-informed discussions is very valuable. Addition that goes into that is the threat assessment training that happened last spring for the schools, for students who are exhibiting some at-risk behaviors. That happened last spring, February through April, and again a follow-up this month, actually, earlier this month, for those who didn't get it in the previous year. So the next thing I wanted to go into is just some of the ed code and assembly bill changes that have happened over the past several years that really started the paradigm shift in student discipline. The first one, the first big one that came was in 2012. And, you know, all the administrators can speak to this because this is one that really affected schools. And so it was Assembly Bill 1729, again, that came in 2012. And so that is part of Ed Code 48900.5 and 48900V. It was added to it. So this Assembly Bill and subsequently the Ed Code changed says that schools must first employ other means of correction. Only when those are not successful may we suspend. Alternatives to suspension or expulsion provided must be age appropriate and designed to address and correct the student's specific misbehavior. And it does allow a student may be suspended on a first offense if the student's presence in school is deemed a danger to others or if it's an educational code violation 48900 A through E. Those are the only ones that students are allowed to be suspended on the first offense. So this is one that really kind of changed the discipline practices that have been going on in many schools. Not exclusive to Roland Unified, this is across the state. The next one that was probably even larger and made a bigger change in education is AB 420, Assembly Bill 420, which happened in 2014. And it provides the following pieces. It says that students in grades kindergarten through third grade are not allowed to be suspended for violation 48900K. And 48900K says defiance or disruption. So it says students in grades kindergarten through third grade may not be suspended at all, ever, for Ed Code 48900K. And students in 4 through 12 may only be suspended if other means of correction have been implemented and failed. And another big piece to us is that recommendations for expulsion for all grade levels for 48900K are prohibited, absolutely. Again, this is a big change in education. Again, not Roland Unified, but statewide, because the referrals that happen from the classrooms and that the schools get, in many cases, K, the defiance or disruption is the biggest one that comes to the offices. And so some things that we have to think about are, you know, have we tried other means of correction? What grade are they in? And et cetera. So knowing that the law had changed and said this really made us more thoughtful about how we address students that have disruption or defiance. Another one changed that maybe wasn't as big of a one to really change what happens in the schools is Assembly Bill 667, which just happened in 2017, and it talks about and it changed Educational Code 48911, which is the due process for students. So this says that suspensions shall be preceded by an informal conference conducted by the principal or designee in which the following must take place. So students must be informed of the reason for the disciplinary action and be provided the evidence against them on why they're being suspended. The student shall, and Ed Code, you know, when Ed Code uses shall, it's a must, not has an option. Sometimes we use them interchangeably, but that's not the case when it comes to Ed Code. If it says shall, we must do these things. So the student shall be informed of the reason and the evidence against them. The student shall be given the opportunity to present his or her own version, and a statement must be made in writing. And the student must be informed of the other means of correction that have been afforded him or her prior to the suspension. And so, you know, again, that's just making sure that the student's due process rights are not violated and that we're providing that to them. Another one I want to touch on today is Educational Code 48900, I'm sorry, 48910, which is teacher suspension. I apologize. Thank you. This is not a new EDCO. This is actually one that's been around for quite some time, but it has, because of some of the other EDCO changes and assembly bills that happened, this has been a little more prevalent of a topic that has come up. So this is the right that teachers have to suspend a student for up to 2 days, which is the remainder of that instructional block that they're in, and the following day. For example, in a high school, if I am a math teacher and a student has a ed code violation, I may suspend them for the rest of that period and the math period the following day. It was designed for high school. When it comes to using it in elementary school where they're in the same class all day long, it becomes a little more tricky because it was never designed or written into the assembly bill for that, but it can be used for that. But the same rules apply when it comes to implementing 48910 that talk about that we talked about in the previous ones. So if a teacher decides to use educational code 48910 to suspend a student from their class, again, for the remainder of that period and the next day during that same period, they first must be able to articulate the ed code that was violated. So again, it's required an ed code violation to be able to suspend a student for 48910. So they have to be able student had to have violated an ed code, and we have to be able to identify which ed code was violated, what other means of correction have already taken place, and the teacher must invite the parents to a conference where the ed code violation and the other means of corrections that were attempted are discussed. They can also, at that meeting, they may invite the school psych, an admin, if they want, and they must notify the principal immediately when that happens, when they wanted to do that. And the principal, at that point, based on what the referral was for, may choose to suspend themselves from the school. But again, that teacher has that right if they so choose, as long as the ed code was violated. So we have to make sure that still is known that it must be a violation of an ed code in order to do the teacher suspension. So all these things that have happened, you know, over the past 7 years since 2012, when ed code changed and some assembly bills happened, really started a statewide paradigm shift in school discipline, which called for, you know, limiting exclusionary discipline practices, right? So they say suspension and or expulsion is the ultimate exclusionary practice. You know, a student is not learning when they're not in school, and the research shows that it doesn't necessarily, you know, change the behavior. They might come back the next day and do the same thing. That we must have the shift that discipline corrects the behavior rather than punishes, and it a big focus on school climate and student engagement, and that we are to focus on what we can do for the student, not to the student. Ultimately, to work with the student to help improve. Just like with the academic intervention, we want them to get better. We want them to be able to learn at grade level and perform at grade level. Same thing with discipline. As we're working with the students, the ultimate goal is to help them, whether it be through resources we provide in the school or outside the school or in partnership with the family, on helping them correct the behavior to be able to not have that happen in the future. And just like an intervention, academic intervention might take months or longer. Sometimes the same thing happens with the behavior. The intervention will not happen overnight. We're not going to fix them in a day. You know, sometimes we have to have some intensive interventions that help the students correct the behavior moving forward. So how this all ties together, you know, is connecting behavior supports and discipline. So, again, the primary goal is prevention through supports, structures, emphasis on teaching desired behaviors, and that's how we tie into PBIS, with the tiered supports and providing them outside mental health supports if needed, and that the discipline practices reflect current regulations and emphasize student success. So everything we have, we need to make sure that we're in line with ed code and in line with the paradigm shift in education. So kind of in response or about the same time that the ed code and the assembly bills came out in 2012 and 2014, the U.S. Department of Education came out with what was called the Dear Colleague Letter. And the Dear Colleague letter highlighted these specific pieces. that schools, you know, should utilize evidence-based prevention strategies, promote social and emotional learning, provide regular training to teachers and administrators, provide teachers with training in classroom management and effective behavior interventions, align resources for these intervention services, reduce the referrals to law enforcement, ensure the consequences that are appropriate and address the specific behavior, and that we should remove students from the classroom as a last resort. This was not part of an assembly bill or an educational code. This is just from the U.S. Department of Education as recommendations on what schools should do, you know, in line with the paradigm shift in discipline. So these are suggestions, not necessarily mandates. The Dear Colleague letter from 2014 also says the following, that the behaviors should be included. Yes. Well, I apologize. I know. The brain doesn't connect with the hand sometimes. So that the policies should be clear, consistent, age-appropriate procedures and policies. So they should be included in the district and school handbooks and safety plans. That they should be explicitly shared and taught with students. And that's where, and we'll talk in a little bit, that's where PBIS has the perfect piece, because these behaviors should be explicitly taught. Just like we specifically teach academic skills, we should specifically teach behavior skills, not just in kindergarten and first grade where they practice that and you might think about that. No, it should happen every year where it's consistent and clear, explicitly taught behavior expectations. They should be shared with parents at school-wide events and assemblies, shared with community groups, and again, aligned with Ed Code and current legislation. So one of the things I wanted to share is we talked about the need that the Ed Code calls for, is that there's a need for other means of correction before suspension, except in certain circumstances. So often we hear, well, what are other means of correction? Here is a list of some possibilities. This is not an exhaustive list in any way. These are just some ideas of things that are considered other means of correction. You know, so often, in many, many times, one of the first things is conferences between school personnel, with the student, with the parent, sometimes with the teacher, the school psychologist, the PBIS coach, you know, people involved together to try to help the kid learn the skills to be able to display the appropriate behavior. Also, some other means of correction would be giving the kids some mental health support. That could be with the school counselor. It could be with the school psychologist, or it could be with the FRC supports that we have, which are extensive. We'll get to that a little bit later as well. It could include an SST. Sometimes people think an SST, which is a school study team regarding some challenges that students may be having, may be focused on academic concerns, but that's not always the case. Often behavior concerns can also be incorporated with SSTs. Again, it could be a referral for a comprehensive assessment. We have the alternative suspension classroom here in Roland Unified, which is for grades 7 through 12. And including that is also, there's a component of the restorative justice piece, which teaches the pro-social behaviors and those restorative practices. It could be after-school programs that address specific behavior issues. Again, the lot of pieces that we'll talk about a little bit more about PBIS and how that is tied in. It could be community service. And it could be, in our situation in Roland Unified, we have the Alternative Learning Program, which is grades 7 through 12. Again, this is a voluntary program, but it is just some examples of some options we have for some other means of correction available to us and our site administrators. So the next thing, so we're between sections. Yeah, let's pause for questions.
Any question? Lynn?
I have a question.
Sure.
There's a lot about correction, and I just wonder if we're really teaching kids that there are consequences to what they're doing. Is that part of the program, that there are consequences?
Absolutely. Yeah, and we'll touch on a little bit more about that with PBIS, but yes, the schools often, and each school does it a little bit differently, but the schools often have either grade level or school-wide assemblies about appropriate behaviors, and again, the school expectations through PBIS are supposed to be explicitly taught to the students and what's expected and what happens when you don't follow the rules. Again, there's not a black and white piece that says if you do this, this is going to happen, because each situation is different. And depends on, you know, if it's the first offense or second offense. But yes, that is part of the process.
And then when you go further into PBIS, would you be sure to emphasize how PBIS is structured to help high schools? Because the feedback I've gotten from teachers is PBIS in high school is not that helpful. And so I want to make sure we're hitting the right marks when we're sharing with staff about the program and
sure.
the way it's supposed to be.
David?
Yeah, I have several questions. On the beginning, out of 13,302 total population, we have 87 that are Tier 3. Is that what we have right now?
Yes. Well, that was what the schools reported. So based on those students that they've experienced and have tried several things with them who are showing, this is between 19 schools, 87 that are showing those signs of those need of that intensive support, yes.
Now, we...
self-reported.
Right, yeah. I was going to say that. Yeah. We've seen documents in the past where this has been self-reported and it was broken down by schools. How many are at each school, Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3?
That's
what 87 comes from. Right, okay.
Yes.
So on that, is there any audits that are done to check, you know, inter-rater reliability that in one school somebody's a Tier 3 and in another school they're a Tier 2, or another school they're a Tier 2 and they should be a Tier 3? Do we do any of that?
So we have not done it yet, but that is our next step. And so first... it was requested, Donna Friedman actually had a conversation, she and I were talking about it, and I trying to identify Tier 1 and Tier 2. And in a casual conversation, a principal had shared, oh, I have this many Tier 3. So I brought it up and was talking with the principals about it, and we had a variety of definitions to Tier 3. And so working with Eleanor Purdy and with Kevin Despard, we went back and we defined for them specifically, this is Tier 1, this is Tier 2, this is Tier 3. Having this information, then how many students would you identify based on your educated opinion with the information presented here is Tier 2, and how many are Tier 3, and how many of those Tier 3 do you need further support with? From there, and it'll come out later in the presentation, we are working on, and Michael Tincup will address it, with additional training. So, and he and I had a very brief conversation today around that, you know, inter-rated reliability piece of it. So, because there were some students that were listed by one of our schools as Tier 3, and he and I would not identify them as Tier 3. And so it has not been done yet, but now that we have identified student by name, by grade level, and with teacher, we're able to look at it to do a little better job with that calibrating.
And I think that gets into the next page where you talked about different presentations that have been done, different teachings. And it sounds like you're using train the trainers concept where you have one group and then that group trains trainers and then that group trains another set of trainers. The only thing I'm wondering is when you get the initial teaching, like the one from Vicente Bravo, does he allow videotaping of that presentation so we have the original source that we can use?
Well, Vicente Bravo is not at LACO anymore. He was promoted.
But he did the training.
So it was not videotaped, but that was designed specifically for principals and vice principals because it was about the ed code changes and the laws.
Uh-huh.
So the principals and the vice principals are the ones that deal with this on a daily basis. So they're the ones. They were all trained, not just one from each school. They were all trained from him when it came to that.
Yeah, but I think sometimes those laws that kind of handcuff administrators as to what they can or cannot do is helpful for the line staff who's dealing with that behavior to know, well, we can't do this and we can't do this. And that's the reason we're not doing it. That it lets them understand what the parameters are and that we have to act within.
Right.
So from that Vince Bravo training, you'll note that on your side there was staff training that took place, I think it says March 2018 mm-hmm. or something in there, spring of 2018. And so we took a variety of the trainings, and as staff, Nick Garcia, Jason Garcia, and Mari Bordona worked on a PowerPoint presentation, which was a shell for each principal to take back and to present to their staff that had all of that information. So yes, it was somewhat of a trainer of trainers. So Vince presented, there were multiple other trainings. There was a document that was created so that there would be common messages shared, that it would be done in small group by a principal or an assistant principal with each given staff. But yes, you do lose some content, but there's also the relationship of the person that's in the room and how effective is the video versus the live person having the conversation. But your point is well taken in terms of having that common message.
And then there's a fine line that we're walking where we look at definitions. Your first one was, don't punish. We teach, we don't punish. And then the law says we make corrections. And then Ms. Emmekamp was saying there needs to be consequences to the behavior. So how do you, you know, it's very difficult to address all three of those in a positive way. And it's a big challenge that you have to deal with there. The laws that you mentioned, the 667, and does that apply to all grade levels?
Yes, it does.
It does, okay. And the 49, well, all these, 49, 48, 9, 10?
Yeah, they all apply through K through 12, although, okay, as you remember, some of them, you know, have specific pieces for K through 3 and specific pieces for 4 through 12.
Okay. And on your examples of other means of correction, I agree with what Ms. Emmekamp was saying, that PBIS at the higher grade level, especially high school, might not be the most productive intervention. But I don't see on the list peer counseling or support groups. And a lot of times with high school kids, peers are the best way to reach them by having peer groups or peer counseling. And I don't see that on there. Do we use that at all?
I don't believe that is happening at this time.
Oh, okay. And I just want to say, this lays a very, very good foundation, what you just presented now. It's sort of the rubber meets the road, and how we implement this, that's going to be, you know, all tell how it's done.
Absolutely right.
Okay, thank you.
Page 12 then says, share with parents with the discipline and policies and the procedures with the parents. I think that's important because not the parents very know very little about the policies and the discipline policies, and on the third item is that they share with in the school wide event and assemblies. And I don't remember you in the, any what did you do in the past or what do you do in the future.
When it comes to the parent trainings, or informing the parents, that's often done, you know, through the discipline policies that are sent home, or through the student handbook, or through the annual notifications. But when it comes to training the students, that is done explicitly, and that's why it's important to make sure that we calibrate it, and those students are getting those explicit, explicitly taught expectations at every site.
Mm-hmm. Okay. For opportunity like the event tomorrow, the parent involvement academy. And that's a good opportunity for this, but there's only a small group of parents.
Yeah, and that typically would not be the environment that we do this in because it's site-specific.
Right.
And so the Parent Involvement Academy is a wonderful opportunity for parent education and to talk potentially about some of the earlier slides. But when it comes to specific to your child's school, mm-hmm. even within our district, there are different behaviors and expectations right. across the district. So it's hard because that's not only across our district, it's across multiple districts as the audience for that particular event. But it very well could be a session that would cover some of the information that we had in the beginning part of the presentation, just about the changes in the education code. I'm not sure if parents' interest in the changes in the education code. It could be a snoozer, but it is a reality of our work.
That's why it happens. It very often the parents come to the school and come to the office and argue with the parent, with the principal, and with the teachers how and why you suspend my kid and why do you suspend my kid in the way. So that's a misunderstanding between the parents and the school, because the reason the parents don't understand what the policies or the procedures.
Yeah, and that's true. They might not know them. That's why it's important for the schools to be really well-versed with them, so they can articulate to the parents, you know, here's the educational code that was violated. It says it right here. You know, and we do hear that as administrators, that sometimes the parents will be upset. Well, why? Well, it says, you know, this is the violation code 4900A1, which says you can't do these things. So that's why it's important to have these trainings on an ongoing basis, so the administrator and or the teacher, if they're doing the 48910, to explicitly say this is what ed code was violated and this is why the consequence is happening. Or if it's not an ed code violation, here's other, you know, you still did something wrong. Here are some other things that are happening because of this behavior is not acceptable.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I just have a couple on the AB 420. Where K through 3 cannot be suspended. Will later on in your presentation or somebody's tell us how you're dealing with those kids that are having still trouble in the classroom?
Yeah, and so part of that goes back to where we're talking about all the other means of correction. So it's not that they can't be suspended, period. They just can't be suspended for that Ed Code 4900K, which, again, is a big one because that's defiance and disruption.
Oh, but they can be suspended, but not for those two things.
Just for K, yeah, not for K.
Okay.
And the other pieces, there's other pieces that K through 3 cannot be suspended for either, which comes to, like, sexual harassment or other pieces. But those are, you know, very few and far between.
Okay. And with the 48910, do we know how many have been using that? Like, how many teachers have been using that approximately? Have many students?
Sorry, she doesn't have that data. So, yes, I did collect that data, and I provided that information to the board, and I'd be happy to get it for you again. I'm sorry I didn't bring it with me to our meeting today, but I do have that information. There are not very many, no.
And since it's only once every 5 school days, what if that student, after they come back after the first time, 48910, still is behaving, hurting people in the classroom or whatever? Is there something that can be done about that?
Yeah, that's where the other means of correction come into place. So that ed code says can only be once every 5 days. And it doesn't mean the school can still not suspend
exactly. As
long as an ed code was violated.
Yeah. Okay, terrific. And thank you for all the great information.
You're welcome.
Okay. Harry has another question.
Sure. Yeah, one more question. The AB assembly bills, do we know, is there any bill? And the reason I ask is...
So, yes, we get alerts. You get alerts through CSBA. I get alerts. Jeff Frost gives alerts. CTA gets alerts. There's alerts.
Yeah.
So we should know.
The weekly CSBA newsletter, they always have the bills.
Signatures, CTA. Petitions, or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, we get them through AXA and other pieces as well.
Okay.
Next piece, I'm going to go over a brief overview of PBIS. And again, this is just a brief piece. I know you had a study session last year about PBIS, so I'm not going to repeat it. We're just going to touch on a few pieces on how that ties to this presentation. So, you know, PBIS is a framework for enhancing the adoption and implementation of a continuum of evidence-based interventions to achieve academically and behaviorally for all students. So PBIS is not a discipline plan. Sometimes that's, you know, in your question, Lynn, PBIS is not working. It's not a discipline plan. It's structures that are put in place school-wide that should teach, practice, you know, and explicitly reinforce over and over again these desired behaviors, right? And so sometimes it's a little – sometimes when people think PBIS is not for high school, they think of the first piece of it, which is a tier one, which we'll talk about, which is, you know, the gold coins that the kids get in those pieces. And maybe that doesn't work for a high school, but having school-wide expectations that are clear, consistent, across the board, what's acceptable in your class should be the same as your class, you know, and all those things, so kids have a common understanding, will work at every grade and every school when implemented with fidelity. And you'll hear a little bit more about how that's happening at our schools. But again, it's not a curriculum, an intervention, or discipline plan. It's evidence-based practices that are organized in a multi-tiered system, and it's, again, it's the relationship between academic and social behavior of students. So I'm going to touch on each tier just quickly here. So again, as you remember, PBIS is divided into three tiers, tier one, tier two, and tier three. Tier one are those school-wide pieces that are done that, when done with fidelity, should be able to have the desired behaviors by, you know, about 80% or more of the students. Some students will need a little bit more support, and that is generally based on the research and the evidence that shows across the not just in California, because PBIS has been around for a couple of decades, and it's not just California, but that is about 15 to 20% of our students. And again, some students will need that intensive support, which is about 1 to 5%. Based on the data that we've gathered, you know, that's less than 1% here in our district. Not to say those 87 students don't cause some serious disruptions. We know that they do, and that's why we have some recommendations going forward. But generally, that's about, you know, 1 to 3% of the students who need some intensive behavior supports. So, oh, there we go. Okay, thank you. So, again, Tier 1 of PBIS focuses on universal prevention, school-wide systems. So this is, again, the investment in prevention. It's a whole school approach to enhance school culture and to have clear, concise, consistent behavior and academic supports and expectations. And that allows us to use the data that's collected when there are referrals for minor or major behaviors, that we can use that data to explicitly determine who needs more support and what kind of supports will we provide. Some examples of some Tier 1 supports. Again, it's teaching, and these are things that are done school-wide. Everybody gets these. When a student needs Tier 2 supports, we don't stop Tier 1. Those Tier 1 things still happen on an ongoing basis for everybody in the school, but then some students need a little bit more. So some examples of some Tier 1 supports are, again, teaching and learning some expectations, making them consistent for students, positive reinforcement for desired behaviors, just like students who are positively rewarded for doing well academically, you know, whether it's honor roll, whether it's thank you, sir. No, but it doesn't go right away. There we go. And it's putting those structures and routines in place to prevent misbehaviors. And that, again, is where that data piece comes in. The Tier 1 PBIS teams look at that data that's collected from all the teacher referrals, both minor that are handled in the classroom and or major, and the PBIS team should look at that data on a regular basis to be able to make those decisions about how to support the students and the teachers. The next piece is the Tier 2, right? So the Tier 2 is those students who need those additional supports. Again, this is a targeted group of students. These are at-risk students who may be exhibiting some signs of some behavior problems, or sometimes some pretty major problems that we hope we can address and help them, give them the supports they need so they don't need those Tier 3 supports. These are more targeted, particularly with social skills instruction. So this is having them, you know, meet with teachers or sometimes peers to talk about their behaviors and to have some expectations. It's increased adult monitoring and positive attention. Those reminders, those reinforced, explicitly taught, just like a student who needs some academic supports. These are some extra supports that these kids receive to help them get back on track. They should receive specific and regularly daily feedback and academic supports if necessary. And again, all goes back to data. We have to be able to implement PBIS with fidelity so we have the data to be able to show what is needed, what's working, and what needs to be improved. So that's that piece. Finally, is the supports we give for the Tier 3 behaviors, and this is the intensive prevention, and we know this is something that we need to be better at as a district, and we'll talk about that later on, and we're going to have some next steps that talk about how we know this is something that is out there, and we know that we need to improve our Tier 3 supports for our students. These are evidence-based, highly individualized supports, try to figure out the reason behind the behaviors. Behavior, just like a lot of other things, is a science. Students, in fact, we were just talking about today when we were doing our school visits, Donna, behaviors, students don't do behaviors just because. There's always a reason, and there's a science behind it. So part of that Tier 3 is understanding, you know, the antecedents, the causes, and all those pieces, and Mike will be getting into that. Mike Tinkup will begin that a little bit later. And these students obviously need frequent monitoring, evaluating, and reassessing. Some ways we provide some Tier 3 supports is having a broader team support these students, which includes the principal or vice principal, psychologist, and other staff. We're going to talk a little bit more today about the psychologist team protocol. Dr. Tinkup's going to go over that. Engage in some CPI, which stands for Crisis Prevention Intervention. Oh, Institute.
Crisis Prevention
Institute. Yeah. Which is a training that we have available, which big piece of it is de-escalation techniques that are available, because that's important for administrators to know, and in many cases, teachers as to know. We also consider discipline options when it comes to these Tier 3 supports if students are exhibiting some very extreme behaviors. And regardless of discipline, we have to develop a behavior action plan for these students, and, of course, have our FRC provide some other supports that are available with outside agencies. Another key is making sure that behavior plan is implemented with that support. So the last slide I have before I turn over to Mr. Garcia is to talk about what happens when a behavior is reported, right? Because as you know, as a school administrator, referrals come in often. Often more so at the secondary schools than the elementary schools, but not to say they don't happen in elementary schools. Some of the times the biggest challenges come from the little ones who don't know how to control themselves or haven't quite learned what's expected and how to do that. So we think about what do we do when a behavior is reported. So a lot of things, and you'll hear from the principals and the vice principals here about what they do. It's a challenging thing to think about. We have to make sure we're thinking about all the pieces when it comes to student behaviors. First thing we think about is, was there an ed code violation? Okay? Because, again, only when a student violates an ed code can we even consider suspension. And only when it's certain ones can we consider a suspension on the first offense. So we think about, is there an ed code violation? Is the action a suspendable offense if there was a violation? Again, is this a first offense? Because we learned earlier that only in Ed Code 48900 A through E may we consider a suspension on a first offense. Only those five violations. Have other means of correction been attempted? And if they haven't, what shall we attempt or what can we attempt? Is the alternative suspension an option? In our district, it's 7 through 12, so sometimes that's an option that we can give them an intervention because they're gonna practice those restorative practices in the ATS here that we have. If it's an ongoing piece, is the alternative learning program a possible possibility for some students? Again, that's 7 through 12 in our district. For those really severe circumstances, is this a possible expulsion? Of course, expulsion is the ultimate punitive consequence. Not saying that we don't do it. You get them on occasion when there is someone that is a recommendation from the school to expel the student because some behaviors are necessary to take that action. When we have a ed code violation, have we done thorough documentation of behavior in Aries or in Swiss? Because it's important to have that documentation so we can see, was a pattern established? Is this an ongoing piece? What interventions have we done? What interventions can we try? We want to, again, correct the behavior is our ultimate goal. Again, are they interventions clearly articulated in Aries? And what are the appropriate timelines? When it comes to suspensions, and specifically with expulsions, we have very clear timelines that Ed Code calls out we must meet. You must do this within 5 days. You must do this afterwards. So all these things are what's considered, and these are not only the things that the principal or vice principal considers when they have a referral, but these are some of the major ones that we consider. So this is the end of this section, so I'll pause here for a couple more questions before I turn over to Mr. Garcia.
Board, do you want to wait on questions for PBIS until we hear Nick's presentation because he may answer some, or would you like questions now? Okay, go ahead, Lynn.
Actually, I want to step back a little bit because I think the board needs to have a better understanding of what happens when a child is referred, say, to the office.
Yes, that's next.
All right.
And so these are what we consider, but specifically, they're going to talk about what do I do as a practitioner. They're going to speak about that.
David?
This might be answered also. When you have a target behavior, that behavior can happen in the classroom or it can happen outside the classroom. And you talk about data collection. How do you collect data when it's occurring all over the campus?
Mr. Garcia is going to touch on that.
Okay.
And that's where the Swiss comes into place.
Okay.
And you'll see how wonderful it is.
Okay.
Yeah. Nick, real fast, are you going to be talking about how Giano did it last year? I don't know if you did it this year at the beginning of the year, how you rotated the classes and mixed up all the kids.
For the teaching of our school-wide expectations.
PBIS?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. I just wanted to ask that question. Okay, so now we'll go to the next thing.
Wait, I think Carrie had one.
On this page, Donna. On this page, and when behavior reported, you mean teacher report to principal or principal report to your office?
No, when the teacher reports to the principal. Yeah,
principal.
Yeah, I apologize for not making that clear.
And
yes.
The principal is the one determining is the violation of ECHO or
well,
or how?
Both. Sometimes the teacher, you know, if they're going to implement the 48910 where they want to suspend them from their class, mm-hmm. they have to know the ed code and say, this is the ed code that was violated. But usually it's a referral to the principal when they are potential suspendable offenses. When we think an ed code was violated, mm-hmm. they are reported to the principal. Mm-hmm. And many times the principals or vice principals do contact me if they're unsure. You know, was this an ed code violation? Is this a suspendable offense? Is this a possible expulsion? So that's where my role comes into place. I'm on the phone daily with principals or vice principals about those behaviors when it's not clear, when it's not a clear-cut piece.
So we're going to go through the process of what happens when a teacher reports a behavior, so a referral to the office. What are some of the steps that are taken at the local site level?
Hey, good evening, everyone. As Dr. Mitchell mentioned, my name is Nick Garcia. I'm assistant principal at Giano Intermediate. I've been in that role for 3 years now. Prior to that, I was a high school teacher in South Central Los Angeles. And just to speak to Mrs. Ebenkamp's question about PBIS being successful at the secondary level, from personal experience, both the high school and at Giano, we have had tremendous success with PBIS. But I would like to reiterate, you know, Dr. Despard's comments about PBIS being an approach to dealing with student discipline and not a discipline plan itself. The challenge of the site administrators and really the site teams is to create a behavior plan that incorporates the tenets of PBIS, but also that is in line with Ed Code. At Giano, we place a heavy emphasis on, you know, teaching and having conversations with teachers early on in the year about what does it mean to be positive? What does that mean? What does it mean in our interactions with students and our communication of expectations, but also what does it mean to be proactive as well? So the teaching of expectations to students, reminding them frequently of those expectations, having sound instructional practices in our lesson planning so that we know what types of students we have, what types of activities will most engage them in the learning, and try to be as preventive as possible in trying to alleviate the behaviors before they even happen. So trying to be proactive instead of reactive in our policies of behavior. So that's a big component to what we do. I've been asked to present to the board today our specific actions that we take in terms of reporting student behavior. So again, we know that about 80 to 90%, 80 to 100% in some cases, the teaching of expectations, reminding them of expectations is going to avoid a lot of behaviors. But again, the challenge becomes is when that anywhere from, you know, 5 to 10%, 20% of students in some cases do need other reminders and do need interventions, what are the policies in place? At our school, it is a priority that we aim to have our policies that are both clear and consistent. So we strive for clarity and consistency, and that's why we do a good job early on to not only teach the students but also to staff in terms of what do we do in these cases. So I'd like to share a couple of documents that we use at Giano, one of our first tasks. So at the beginning of the semester, we do have one of the first steps of developing a PBIS program is to come up with a school-wide matrix that clearly outlines school expectations in a variety of areas at school. So whether it be in the bathrooms, the library, the schoolyard, the hallways, just how we expect students to behave. And another important component about PBIS is that it's not the job of an individual or a committee. It takes the entire staff. So we divide up those lessons to teach expectations to all teachers at our school site. So the science department may say, hey, you know what, we want cafeteria. We'll take on cafeteria, and through that first week of school, they explicitly teach, take students out, show them how to line up, how to walk through the cafeteria, which door to enter, which door to exit. So those expectations are taught so that when they do need reminders, that expectation is there that students have already been taught what our expectations are for behaving in different areas of the school. We also go over it as a staff. It is broken up by department, so departments get a chance to get together and say, how do we best teach this to our students? These are our students. We know their needs. How best can we teach these expectations to them? Also, per Ed Code, Mr. Ochoa and I As administrators, go to every classroom. We utilize our history classrooms where we go specifically over ed code and suspendable offenses. So again, students are very clear about our expectations around behavior, but they also understand what those consequences can be if they engage in those, you know, 48, 900, A through R behaviors. As someone who, you know, manages our behavior plan at school and obviously often is the one suspending students, I can tell you it helps a lot. Again, in that proactive approach that we're teaching students that they're aware of the consequences, so when those situations happen, they almost know what to expect, and there's not so much of a negative interaction around those consequences. So that's also a big help as well. Next, I'd like to get some of our documents. You guys do have some presentation reference materials. I'd like to direct you to page 9. Which is our first report. Is there a way to? We do have an example here. This is one of the first tasks we had at Giano was to delineate between minor behaviors and major behaviors. So what is the difference between a student, you know, that just doesn't want to move his seat? Is that defiance? Or is that a student being uncooperative? This is also part of the staff training we do where we norm our practices and we talk about this so we can differentiate between a student being uncooperative and defiant. So what we did through collaborative efforts is to identify, to limit the number of behaviors that are most often in classrooms. So our minor incident report, as you can see here, is a half sheet. We offer it in paper for teachers to fill out, but also a digital form through Google Forms that they can submit via the Google Form. All this information goes to my office and is inputted through SWIS, which is our school-wide information system, which I will speak to in a second. But the purpose of this report is to be quick, a quick way to report not only the behavior, but also the means of correction being employed by the staff member and possible motivation. If you see the behaviors that we have mentioned there, they're all considered minor behaviors, so it might be a dress code violation, inappropriate use of a cell phone, inappropriate comment or act, being uncooperative, disruptive, eating in class or chewing gum, some horseplay, out of their seat, being habitually tardy to a particular period, cheating, profanity, being unprepared, or off task. So those are the major behaviors that we as a staff said, this is what happens in classrooms. This is what we see. We try to combine as much as we can in order to keep it very concise. As you can see here, none of these are ed code violations. Now, they are inappropriate behaviors. We tell students these are inappropriate behaviors. Again, our expectations are that you are on task, that you are cooperative with the teacher's directives. But we know at times that may not happen. So this is the method they use to report it. Now, this does not mean students are being sent out of class. They can, if the means of correction is other, perhaps they think that a conversation with me is warranted, they may send them to my office. But this is not designed for a student to be exited from class. Again, in line with ed code, our priority is to keep students in the classroom. But the bottom line is I am going to be aware of the behavior so that I can now have a conversation with that student. And let me tell you, it's very powerful when I catch a student on the yard and I can say, you know, why were you in Ms. Morales' class? Why were you talking today? That's the second time this week. And kids look at me like, how did you know that? You know, I didn't go to your office. They didn't tell me where they were going to tell you. But I'm aware. And again, I can be proactive about it and speak to that student before it escalates into a bigger issue. Any questions about our minor incident report?
Under location, where do you find that most of them occur?
I'll show you in a second, but classroom. By far, it is the classroom. That's what's really great with SWIS because we can have those conversations of, oh, no, this is going on. Well, let's look at the data. Is it really a problem there? Our second one that we have is our major office referral. And just as the name indicates, these are major behaviors. So these are serious behaviors that we believe warrant more serious interventions, intensive interventions, and more serious consequences as well. So here, what we've done here with our major referral form is we've aligned all these behaviors to ed code violations A through R. Now, for the sake of space on the form, we combine some that are applicable to each other. But they are all in line with ed code violations. What we communicate to parents, what we communicate to students is that when you get a referral, this is a message that you are on your path to suspension because these all warrants can be used to suspend. So these are more serious. I'm having a conversation with you. I'm speaking with your parent. This is something that has now moved beyond a minor behavior and is something a little more serious. Again, does not mean we will suspend on the first offense. And per ed code, our obligation is to provide other means of correction to try to correct the behavior before we suspend. But it is a clear message. This can lead to suspension if it is not corrected. If you could see, if we scroll down, the form first part is similar in terms of location and violation, also a brief incident report. but you also see there are some actions taken. And on here on this form, you do see some punitive consequences. At Giana, we do use a demerit system, which, you know, again, part of the positivity at our school is to have school-wide celebrations, recognitions, school being a place kids want to be in. I want to go to that dance. I want to participate in this club. Well, in order to do so, you must maintain good behavior. And one way to track students who may not be exhibiting that behavior is through our demerit system. We have detentions that we utilize. We have suspensions, whether it be in the period, in school, or out of school suspension. We also, as always, maintain our interventions with counseling, maybe a referral to the counselor, school psychologist, FRC. At times, we may have to get law enforcement involved. Other times, we may put them on a behavior contract or other interventions that are not specifically listed on this form here. This one does require parent signature. So if I am not having a meeting with the parent, I am calling the parent, informing them that they will be going home with the referral and that I require their signature and it to be returned the next day. If that is not the case, I call the parent and ensure that they are aware of the behavior. Any questions about our major referral form? All these are also inputted into ARIES as well as SWIS. So because they are Ed Code violations, they will go into SWIS, which is improving our documentation as well. Next is our behavior response blueprint. This one is really meant to be for teachers, and it's a way to systemize our responses to behavior. So when we say, well, what do I do? When does a minor become a major? This one is designed to say at level one, this mirrors our minor incident report. So all those behaviors are the same ones on the MIR form. Means of correction also the same. I'd like to bring your attention to PBISworld.com. It is a great resource for interventions. So we're not limited to those means of correction. Teachers can always go on to PBISworld.com. There are several behaviors that are listed there. You see your kid. Kid is unprepared for class every day, and it gives you a variety of interventions that you can employ in order to support that student's positive behavior. Consequences at that level are teacher managed. So that's that section there. What I've tried to do in level two is to say, okay, four or more repeated minors with multiple means of correction. We do talk about that with our staff. It's not enough to warn, referral. You need to do some other things. We need a conference with student. We need to call parents. So I say it cannot go to the major referral until a parent has been contacted. And what I message to parents is that I can't be the first person communicating to that parent that, hey, your student has been disruptive for the past 3 weeks in this class. They're going to want more details that I may not be able to provide because I'm not in that class. But if I could see from our, again, SWIS, that can show I know that you've been contacted already, I know that the teacher has reached out to you, I know that they are aware of the situation. And now it's just a follow-up from an administrator. But in level two, what we have with the behaviors is we have Ed Code violations, but they are only obscene act, habitual profanity, and willful defiance. The reason I put those three, because level two is an example of minors that turn into majors. So really with the Ed Code, there's not a lot of things that are turned into majors. If you look at the first two, obscene act and habitual profanity, well, they are in line with inappropriate comment or act or profanity in the minor section. So a student curses, inappropriate, not acceptable, we remind them, we conference them after class, perhaps inform their parent. But if it becomes a pattern, then we're going to have to say, you know what, I know you've made some inappropriate comments and we've warned you and I've spoken to your parents and I've kept you after class to talk to you, but now I think you need to go speak to Mr. Garcia and I'm going to send you on a referral for habitual profanity. And again, what the Ed Code calls for is that we have documented other means of correction, and that's why this system helps, because I can say you've already been warned three times about your language. Now it is an Ed Code violation for habitual profanity or an obscene act in that case. What we see is that everything else in the minor behavior column will translate into willful defiance. So we have a student that is disruptive or uncooperative. They're eating gum. They're always messing around. They're horse playing, and they do it over and over and over. There's not necessarily an Ed Code for that besides defiance. I've told you. I've warned you. I've reviewed expectations with you, and you continue to engage in that behavior. So I am going to say it's now defiance. So that's how we align it there. Level three could be a repeated level two behavior, but also the other Ed Codes that are listed there as well. As you can see, we never stop means of correction. But in level three, if you scroll down a bit, you see in level two and level three, the consequences do increase. So that stereotype that, or that, you know, idea that PBIS equals no consequences, no punitive consequences. That's not what we do at Giano. It is part of our behavior plan, but again, it's not our first go-to. We can say we are trying our means of correction, but at a certain level, at the level two, we will be providing detention, demerits, and also our alternative to suspension. Now, if it gets to level three, that's when we need to say, based on our documentation, we may have to start suspending, giving more demerits, perhaps contact law enforcement, consider administrative transfer, suspended expulsion, and in very rare cases, recommend for expulsion as well. I know some of the other principals are going to talk about SWIS, so I'll just go over just some of the benefits that we have. It really helps us. I'm sorry. Now, here we go. So it's really data collection. It really helps, you know, one, it records all behaviors, but also the means of correction. And that's what we communicate to teachers well. It's not just for recording behavior. Yes, that's one function, but equally as important, if not more important, is recording the means of correction, documenting those means of correction so that the behavior continues. We have that documentation. It is manually inputted by our office staff, and it greatly helps in facilitating data talks collaboratively amongst teaching groups. So we have core teachers, grade level teams, all teaching the same kids. What's going on with these students? Well, let's look at the data to facilitate those conversations. With individual students, when they're in my office, it helps facilitate those conversations because I point to the data and they know what's going on and they know that we're aware of it. Also with teachers and parents, also again, great to facilitate those conversations because we have evidence and documentation of what specific behaviors and means of correction have been employed.
Does this include when they, you said they had you had to make sure if they called the parents. So this will be also in this list that I called the parents on this day, and then I called the parents on this day, and you have all that documented.
Yes, and in supporting teachers, if a teacher is, hey, the student just continues with this behavior, and I can look, or I can ask, have you contacted parents? Well, I haven't done that yet. You know, please try to reach out to parent. That could be a lever that we can use to institute change. It may not be. In many cases, parents are unresponsive, but we have that documented as something we've already attempted. Maybe I will attempt again. That may not be a means of correction, so we employ other interventions and supports. Some of the data, just really quick, I know other principals are going to share some of their data. This is one by location. So when we ask the question, where are most of our behaviors? By far in the classroom. So this informs our Tier 1 team to say, what type of PD maybe do we need to do? Do we need to utilize PD to maybe talk about what are best instructional practices to address behaviors in class? Well, which behaviors? Well, let's look. Mainly, surprise, surprise, at a middle school, we have disruption. That is the primary behavior that we see happen. This also helps with, you know, sometimes with people may say, there's a lot of things going on. Well, let's look at the data. We're very proud at Giano that we do not have a lot of fights. We do not have a lot of drugs going on. Yet, we do have our issues, and this helps focus our efforts because we can say, hey, you know what? We really need to do something about disruption. Hey, that tech there, we need to do something about cell phones. What do we need to do? Do we need to review those expectations again, utilize our advisory period to reteach our expectations around that? This is both major and minor, so this is everything in there. You could see defiance there on the right side, on the first defiance all the way to the right with the higher numbers, that's an M defiance, that means it's a minor. If you move down a little to the left, you see defiance, those are the majors that have been reported. So even in looking, grade level, 8th versus 7th, this will change in the spring semester at Giano. Minor versus major, this is also some good data to say, hey, what's going on? We have a lot of minors. Even in being critical of our practices, is it maybe time that, hey, maybe we need to get off the minors and say, maybe it is now time, based on this blueprint, that we should stop with the minors and start turning them into major referrals, and this helps inform those discussions and norm some of our practices as well. This one is by staff, so again, we can have conversations with individual staff members. We always keep it confidential, staff names. When we disseminate data, we never include staff names in our data reports, but it helps me. Maybe a teacher does need individual support, and it helps inform me about what teacher that I can maybe go support and say, hey, I noticed we've had a lot of incidents in your class. What's going on? What support can I offer? Maybe I drop by that certain period. It's been fifth period, and I'm going to visit that class to be present during that period. And lastly, by student, we can also see, okay, where are Tier 2 students? Are these students in the right hand of the section receiving the most reports? Are they receiving Tier 2 supports? Are they working? Do we need other interventions and supports in place?
Just a quick question. So the bigger the graph means that one teacher or that one student
had more reports.
More.
And I tell my teachers all data is good data. So it might even be kid was chewing gum. Well, okay. Some teachers really enforce the dress code. Some teachers are out there getting cell phones every day, and that's so even though their numbers may be high, it just means that teacher's really looking out for dress code. In other cases, it may be this teacher's really struggling with some disruption in the class. Let me offer them some assistance and utilize our resources in order to provide them the support. Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Yes, people are often very surprised by the high number of referrals we have, but they are. And like I tell teachers, it's all data is good data. So some of them may be dress code violations, kids chewing gum. It's everything that's listed in there. And again, it's not always that this is a problem behavior. It's I encourage my teachers to report all behaviors of concern so that we can identify patterns.
Mr. Garcia, it might be good to go back to the major minor so Mr. Chen can see the number of majors and minors. It looks like a lot, but that's how many of them are minors, Mr. Chen. You know, a lot of them are minor referrals. This is the smaller number is the number of major referrals, you know, the ed code violations.
I mean, more than 1,000, how do you digest this data? It's hard for
periodically. So that's another element, too, that's very important, is that we're reviewing this almost daily. Because if you wait, then you can't disseminate the data. So it's very important that I'm looking at this data daily. And there's a great element on SWIS to tell you all recent referrals, so you can see. And if I see gum, I mean, it's not that doesn't grab my attention. But if I see a certain student's name that I know is a Tier 2 student and we've been tracking, and I look at the behavior, then I'm going to have to respond to that.
And unless you analyze data and sort them, otherwise you won't be able to use them.
And the SWIS does offer a lot of great features to disseminate the data in usable fashion.
But all of those were not in your office. A lot of them were that minor one that was
the majors, yes.
Yes.
All those majors made it to my office. But the minors, and some are. And sometimes that's another conversation to have of one of the other interventions is time in office. And sometimes we need to have a discussion about whether that was appropriate.
So your school, 7th and 8th grade, about the same number of kids?
About a little bit more than 7th graders. Anyway.
Yeah, so because these two bars, one high, one lower,
yes. I show it to you in June, sir. It's gonna be clear. So those are trends we see.
I remember when I was working that we had a similar data input system, and it was for different types of errors in a hospital, and was tracked by employee. And when that employee hit a certain number of certain type of error, then automatically kicked that employee's name out, and you know, gave it a red flag. So you turn your computer on in the morning after you entered your data, and those would pop out that have had two. You could set the parameters, 2, 3, 4, whatever. So like for those 1,000, over 1,000 minors, that if there's like 3 or 4 students that's kicking that up, it would kick their names out automatically. You wouldn't have to sort through it.
Yeah, and what I do with another one that they say show students, like for this one I sorted by 10 or more. So that's what I'll start doing. And I can put dates so I can see this week, in the last 2 weeks, last 3 weeks, let me disseminate that data. And it's not so overwhelming. Yeah. This is everything for the entire school.
So you have to manually sort it rather than it kick it out.
Yes.
Yeah. I just looked at that PBIS World website. Man, that's a fantastic website. Everybody has access to that?
Absolutely.
I have another question about PBIS. We've been talking about data. Who at the schools go through the PBIS data? Kevin mentioned a team. So each school has a team that's responsible for that. When do they do that work, and how much time does it take?
Yeah, each school has a couple teams, but I'll let Nick talk to the specific, because each school does it a little bit differently. But let's talk about how you do it at your school, because it is a team effort. It can't be just the principal and the vice principal. It must include a team, because this is everyone involved, and these are all of our kids. TFI.
And I've given you, the board has seen some of that data.
We have our Tier 1 and Tier 2 teams. So our Tier 1 looks at a lot of school-wide data. So they'd probably be looking at data around that grade level. More importantly, these type of behaviors and where they're happening.
Are those teachers?
Teachers. So we have a community lead. So there are community leads from each of the departments, from each of the communities. And it's myself and our interventions coordinator that's in there as well. Our PBIS coach also leads that team. So that's looking at more macro data. We also have a Tier 2 team, which looks at more individual data. So we're tracking individual students and determining, do we need to assign them Tier 2 interventions and supports? And those already on Tier 2 interventions and supports, it helps us track them to see if those interventions and supports are being effective. And then, like I said, myself and my secretary, we're looking at data daily and making it a point to sit down and look at weekly trends as well.
How many Tier 3s would you say you have at Giano?
At Giano, out of 585, I would say we have about 5 students that are at Tier 3 level.
Or intermediate.
Referral by students. The one on page 30, there's our 50 students. Are these our student numbers?
This one, yes. By student, yes, these are student numbers.
So only 50 kids.
I did it because I did it 10 or more. So students are only at 10 or more. So if I do at least one, then we have obviously a lot more. But part of the tiered fidelity inventory that Dr. Mitchell referred to is looking at the numbers of students who got less than one to two, and then, you know, more than three. Mm-hmm. So we disaggregate that data. But for these students, there's only been, if you counted 50, these are the students who have 10 or more.
Is it one school year?
In one school year.
One school year.
And it could be minors or majors. In this case, yeah.
Hi, good evening. I'm Dr. McGee. I'm from Roemer Elementary School, and I'm here to talk about the SWIS program at the elementary school level. So I use SWIS at Northam, where I was at. I used it about 2 years, and we found that it had a lot of valuable data. And this is how it looks in the elementary schools, and very similar to Giano. They have a referral form, and teachers input it online. I, as well as my TOSA, gets a report of who had an incident report for the day, and again, collecting the data. So you can see right here that our focus is kindergarten, first grade. So it helps not only us collect the data on the student, but also us on how to be active and go out there. But I'll show you right now where it happens the most, and you'll see why we go out there during kinder and first grade. We have right here the different locations, not as many as Giano, but it's what pertains to our school. So we have the hallways, bathrooms, cafeteria, playground, and classroom. You can see that a lot of it happens in the playground and in the classroom. At what time of the day it happens. So we could even pinpoint it to what time of the day. And just by looking at this and analyzing this, I can tell you that it's during recess time and recess lunchtime. So these are the different behaviors that were referred to, and a lot less than Giano, but this is what pertains to our school. You can see the last one is actually physical aggression, and we already know that's just one student. The other ones are just different students, and I'll show you the numbers right now.
Okay.
It's going to go all three of them.
So it's page 34. We've got way too many pieces of paper. All right, okay.
And right here is referrals by students, and it's all our students, all the referrals, and they don't have names, they have their numbers, and you can see, and this helps us because it also helps us provide interventions for the students that are continuously getting a referral. One of the ways, let me go back to the other one. Just one of the things that we do when students are referred continuously, and we do meet as a team as well, and just not only as a PBIS team, and just to look at the data and analyze the referrals and see where we can provide support, but also as a SST team, and June will be talking about the SST team that we have at our schools, and we meet as a team to provide support for some students. These are minors. If we do have that, don't have to do anything with the ed code. My one student, the physical aggression is in the lower grade, so it doesn't have to do with the ed codes. However, we do have situations where we do have referrals for maybe some kind of ed code violation. And I'll give you an example of a situation that happened about 2 months ago. Maybe a student brought something that he wasn't supposed to. So it happened at the end of the day. The other gave it to another student. The other student brought it back. And mom brought him back with that item. And, ed code was followed. Based on the ed code, the consequence was given to him. But more so, we have to remember also that besides a consequence given to that student, we also have to remember that we teach our students not only academics but also behavioral and social, because we're teaching them to become productive citizens. One of the things that we do emphasize at Roemer, and just my own belief that if, you know, my children are the most important thing in life, and that's the way that I believe that we should treat our students. And if students make bad choices, wrong choices, it's a learning experience. And, you know, you really have to take these incidents, isolated incidents. You have to consider the student, consider the background, consider their life. Give the students, you know, strategies and interventions so that student can be successful. And June will talk more about how we do that at the schools.
Good evening. My name is June Sakaua, the principal at Blandford. So today I'll be sharing with you our process for an SST. Our teachers, So students in our class have diverse needs. We know that we have academic needs and behavioral needs and social emotional needs. And our teachers are focused not only on providing first best instruction and making sure they're implementing best practices, they also have to make sure they're meeting the individual needs of the students. There comes a point when teachers say, I've tried everything, and I've tried everything in my toolbox. I need help and I need support. And that's where the SST comes in. SST stands for a student success team. It can also be called a student study team. And it consists of an administrator, classroom teacher. We invite the parents. We also reach out to other support members of our staff. For example, it could be a school psychologist. It could be an FRC liaison, a member of the PBIS team. But really, it's a chance for a team to brainstorm what's happening with the child inside the classroom, but also find out more information about the child at home, understand the student's strengths, specific areas of concern, so that we can work together on building a support plan for a student. I'd like to share about our SST process, and if you refer to the reference materials on page 2, this is what we shared with our staff, so they're also aware of what to do when they have a student that they want to provide more support and ask for more help. Before requesting an SST, page 2 of the presentation reference materials.
If you want to just
look at the screen here, that's okay too. So when a teacher is interested in referring a child for an SST, we make sure that they've already looked into a student's CUE. Maybe there's additional information that is helpful for a teacher. They've discussed and brainstormed ideas with their grade level colleagues, already tried to differentiate their instruction, trying some classroom interventions in the classroom, and also documenting what they've been doing specifically for that child, and be able to collect some student samples and work samples, so that when they do come to an SST meeting, they're able to share what they've tried and to share, this is all of the different ideas I've tried. Now I'm here because I need more help and I need ideas. So we have a teacher referral page, which is on page 4 of the same packet. And at Blandford, most of our SST referrals for students are for academic needs. However, we know that there's a correlation between students who are at risk academically and behaviors. If a student is struggling academically, then oftentimes you find that they are struggling behaviorally as well. And that's why it's really important to look at a whole child, not just isolated concerns, because we know that there's connections. So a teacher will fill out the referral form, and based on their observations, we ask for how are they doing in reading, writing, math, overall academic performance, and their behavior. We also ask for the teacher's observations and what are the student's strengths, because we always feel that we can build on where the strengths and interests are. And then also the areas of concern, so that we can make sure we target our next steps to address the areas of concern. parent communication is also very key. We don't want a request for an SST meeting to be the first notification that something is wrong with the child. We want to make sure that they've already been communicated about the concerns, and we're here to help as a team to address the needs and find supports and interventions to help a child either academically, behaviorally, or socially. And then, again, that tracking of the intervention is key. We want to make sure that we know what has been tried. So at the meeting, when we discuss together, we come up with different ideas, and we want to make sure that those interventions have been tried with fidelity. That's key, making sure that it's been consistent, that there's been fidelity in it, and then in case we need to try something new, we already know what's been tried. And then during the meeting, one of the most important aspects of the meeting is connecting with the families. We ask, and it's an opportunity for us to connect, find out what's going on also at home, because that information may be crucial in making sure how we support the child at school. It's getting to know the child, the whole child, versus just a student. It's being able to personalize the instruction based on the needs of that student. So that's one of the most important benefits of having an SST. Again, you know, we go over the classroom interventions, and then the team having more ideas in the room can provide additional ideas. A possible referral to Tier 2 interventions. Now we're reaching out to maybe our FRC team and asking for counseling services if that's a need. Or we refer to an intervention skills class because we see that as an academic need. Maybe it's a reading foundational skills class or a math intervention course. A check-in, check-out is also another Tier 2 intervention that we suggest for students who may be a great candidate for that. And there are nomination forms for students who may be a good candidate for check-in, check-out. And then if you go to, yep, go ahead and click that one. This is a tool that we provide teachers to document how they've been providing interventions. Our classroom teachers are doing lots of interventions. However, with the day in, day out tasks that they're doing, sometimes they have challenges in documenting what they're doing. So this is just a tool to let us know when they started the intervention, what they're doing. Maybe it's a small group academic intervention that they're doing, how often they're doing, and the data that they've collected, and what the progress has been. It's another way to collect the data so that we are able to brainstorm more ideas for support at the SST. Another intervention we tried, like I mentioned, was a check-in, check-out. And this is an example of our pause card. And on the top, where it says problem solver, always dependable, works and plays responsibly, shows kindness and respect, those are our Tier 1 expectations and our values that our school has, and it ties in with our PBIS matrix. So those are our core values, and our students who are on check-in, check-out have an adult they check in with that is not their classroom teacher, but it provides a chance for a student to check in with another adult on campus to build those connections with. And then throughout the day, the classroom teacher identifies if they're on the right track, if they need reminders, or if they could have made a better choice in those major areas and specific times of the day. At the end of the day, they also check in with their check-in, check-out teacher, and then they have a conversation about how their day went. They talk about what went well, and if there's any areas that they had a hard time, they talk to their check-in, check-out teacher about that. And it's a way to really motivate students to think about what they're doing, be reflective, and to help them meet their goals. Here's an example of how the check-in, check-out has worked for a particular student. They started in November, and their goal was 80% on meeting these particular expectations. We see that the first day he did fantastic, 100% on his check-in, check-out. Second day, he still met his goal at 80%, and then for the next few weeks, he met his goal of being 80% and above. And at that point, we had done the intervention for about 5 weeks, and it was the end of right before winter break. And we decided as a team that he's been doing so well that he no longer needed the check-in, check-out intervention. So we took him off, and he felt ready and independent enough to make good choices. We came back after winter break, and 2 weeks after, he was like, I think I need to go back on. And it came from the student. And he says, you know, that check-in, check-out really helped me, and I think I need to go back on. We met together as a team again with the teachers, myself, and we you know, discussed the check-in, check-out system, and he went back on. We had one day where he dropped to 75, and then he's been, you know, meeting his goal. This shows us that, you know, students, they're going to have those good days, and there's going to have those days where are really challenging. But overall, they're making good choices. There's going to be days where they need reminders, and that check-in, check-out system is a tier two intervention that really provides them that support to do that. After interventions have been tried, we try to do interventions for at least 6 to 8 weeks before we follow up. And then we have a follow-up SST to see how these interventions have been working. Do we need a tweak? Do we need to intensify the intervention? Do we need to change the intervention? And then if all of the interventions have been tried and we're not seeing improvements, whether it's academically or behaviorally, then possible next steps could be reaching out to our FRC again and seeking for additional supports, reaching out to our special ed team and asking for support through our behavior specialist, which Jason Garcia will talk about, or also even referring to our special ed team for possible additional testing. So with each meeting, we discuss supports and the intensity of support to support our students.
Getting them into testing and all the various steps takes a long time. How did the teachers hang in there?
I think through the SST process, that is a way that we can provide support and make sure that we give ideas to things that they haven't thought of before. And some of those ideas, like the check-in, check-out, it works. And we see that through that intervention, we don't have to move on to any other additional steps because that intervention is working for that child. When we don't see those changes, that's when we have to seek more support and ask for additional support from outside.
Real quick, I just want to say your SST form is very nice. I think it's teacher-friendly. It doesn't take forever, and it's just right.
Mm-hmm. Good evening.
Going back on the referrals by grade level that was on here, do you notice for the like K1 in first grade is the high, or K in first grade is the highest? If the student went through pre-K first, that they're less likely to end up in these categories?
Uh-huh.
I'm just wondering if going through pre-K, they learn appropriate behaviors and it sets the foundation for K in first grade, and they're less likely to fall into these categories, which would give justification for sending a student to pre-K.
Often, yes.
Yeah.
Because sometimes they won't have behaviors displayed in TK.
And then this is for Gianno. This is a chart that was provided to us prior to this meeting, about a month ago. And I noticed Gianno has a high rate of referrals to outside agencies. Can you explain what the outside agency is and how did they get that referral? But because, you know, there's several schools that are making use of it. What was it?
An FRC referral can lead to an outside agency supporting, but FRC is our inside department that we reach out to.
Thought maybe you were coding it as outside because it's not.
But is Gianno coding it as an outside agency?
I need to
page.
Yeah. Of the third.
But what he was saying, though, I agree with him 100% on that, that a lot of times the behavior that we're seeing in this elementary school is a reflection of what's happening in the home environment. And there's either a divorce, the father lost his job, or whatever. And the child's acting out in school as a reflection. And you can punish the child as much as you want. It's not going to change what's happening at home. And that's why I think FRC is so important, so that they can involve the family at home.
The document you're referring to was put together by Laura Lestrada from the FRC. So of the referrals the FRC receives, this is where the services for students have been directed. Okay. So those are outside referrals for outside counseling support outside of the Roland Unified School District.
Oh, okay. I'll touch on that, too, just with our experience. Jason Garcia, principal at Oswald Academy. I was asked to just kind of touch on what my colleagues already had said, but speak about our referral system, but at the same time speak about a direct experience on our campus dealing with a so-called Tier 3 student. I'll be referencing the last two pages on the materials reference or presentation reference materials. As you see there, it's our Oswald discipline flowchart as well as our referral, what it looks like. Just to touch a little bit on what Nick Garcia already talked about, we too take the beginning of the year to teach our students our expectations and our rules. The teachers will take the kids out, show them what it is to be respectful, responsible on our campus, and take them to the different areas, the cafeteria, the hallways, the bathrooms. So we do a big, big lesson at the beginning of the year and at the semester break, and that's TK all the way through 8. So they're getting at the little guys too. So you could see the when they get to kinder, they already have the expectations of what it, you know. You see them walking, eagle tails, eagle beaks, and you see them all. So even at TK, they're learning those expectations already. But we use that. But also teachers during the year, it's an expectation that they actually go through those lessons again. It's not just that we do it at the beginning of the year in the semester. Maybe a teacher takes, like, the hallways. So they'll work on the hallways all that week, you know, and then the next week maybe they'll do the bathroom. So it's a constant rotation that they're getting this expectation of what's expected on our campus. To answer your question, Mr. Chen, we also utilize back-to-school night to teach our parents and inform them of our expectations, our PBIS. Also, we touch a little bit on the law as far as A through E, expulsions and things like that. But also our teachers utilize the back-to-school night as well to inform our parents as well. So we do that. As you see on the discipline flow chart on the left side, we have minors and majors. On the minor side, it's teacher-managed, and you can see the things that are there. Again, it's the last two pages. You got disruption, dress code, playground, cafeteria violations. Those are all teacher managed. There's some sample interventions there that teachers can implement. But on the minors, the teacher writes a referral just like this right here, the last page. Okay, the referral looks like this. They fill it out. And on a minor referral, okay, it's teacher handled. It's teacher managed. Okay, so they're the ones that fill it out. They're the ones that could give a kid a consequence or other means of correction. But it's expected, okay, by our teachers that it doesn't matter if it's the first one, second one, or not. It's expected that they reach out to the parents. Okay, we feel that constant communication of communicating to the parent, this is what's going on. So they do that. It's expected that when they write a minor referral that they communicate to the parents. It could be via email. It could be a phone call. It could be a text. Usually they take a screenshot of this and send it through Remind app, and that's how they get the information to them. Because as parents, you know, your kids, 3 minor referrals equals a major referral on our campus. So when they come to us, and the major referrals are all on the right side. Those are all ed code violations, as you can see on the right side. Those are all admin handled. Okay, so but we also handle 3 minors that equal a major. Now, the reason why we want the teachers to reach out to the parents when it's a minor, because when they come to us the third time, the fourth time, because 3 minors equals a major, when we make the contact to the parent, and you guys as parents, you can see, well, this kid already, this is his fourth time doing this. Well, what do you mean? When was I notified? How come I wasn't notified the first time? We're not sitting here having this conversation with you, Mr. Garcia, if we were informed the first time. So it kind of saves that too, but also keeps them in the loop of the constant communication. So that's why the teacher has to make that constant communication for a minor. All majors on the right side, those are all admin handled. We do the investigation. We provide the interventions. We reach out to parents. We log it into Aries and Swiss. Same thing with interventions. The teacher will do the minor, but they send us up to the office, and we enter it into Aries and Swiss to utilize the same way that all my colleagues said, the location, you know, whether to provide this student the support, teacher support, that kind of thing. So we utilize that as well. And then we make the contact to the teacher via email to keep them in the loop, right? Because sometimes we hear, well, we send them up to the office, what happened? And then, you know, the perception is nothing did happen. So we implemented this year that they receive an email from us, Okay, when it's handled by us, they receive an email explicitly telling this is what happened, these are the steps, this is what I told mom, this is what dad or parent, and so that way they're in the know and they're in the where. So they feel like, you know, they're being supported as well. And again, we utilize the Aries and the Swiss the same way as my colleagues had said. But what happens when, like June was talking about, when you have an SST for a child, but the child needs something more than an SST, right? So I was asked to speak about experience on our campus with a little kindergartner, you know, talking, Dave, speaking of those behaviors are seen at kindergarten, right? We had a little kinder student that came to us at the beginning of the year, and we could tell there's really no structure at home, so to speak. So having to sit 6 hours of the day in a structured classroom, she literally every day would destroy the classroom. She would throw things, take the Lego blocks, just throw them all over. We started the whole SST process, but it's a process, right? You know, you put some interventions in place, you meet with the team, 4 to 6 weeks, give it some time. Doesn't work, sit back again, second SST, put some interventions in place, give it some time. But meanwhile, this is two sets of 4 to 6 weeks that my teacher's having to deal with this, living it daily, right? And so she came to me, said, Mr. Garcia, I need some support. You know, so we're trying this intervention, we're trying that intervention, we're reaching out to my colleagues, you know, have you seen this before? And then they said, reach out to the special ed department and see what, you know, they can offer. It just so happened that at that time, there was a behavior aid that was available. He had finished, I don't know, is it a case or something like that, a student or whatever, finished working with another student, and he was free, right? He was free. So they said, okay, look, we can provide you this aid. And they said, what time exactly does your student act out? We said, right after lunch. Perfect. We'll send them there right after lunch for about an hour and a half. Okay. So for 2 weeks, we had a behavioral aide come and work with our teacher. Now, he was not there for the teacher just to say, okay, you take care of him. It's your problem. Now you're here. You know, let me just teach the class. No, he specifically said at the very beginning, I'm here to work with you to give you the strategies and skills you need so I don't have to be here and you could be able to deal with this tier three kid, so to speak. So an hour and a half and for 2 weeks, and for her, it was life-changing. It was, she felt supported. It was a breath of fresh air. And, but now she has the confidence, and these are her words. I wrote them down. It was beneficial because it was in the moment support. Okay. It's one thing to sit down with a behavior specialist after school or before school and says, when this child acts out, do this. Okay. Then you go through the day, but you know, you kind of forget. You're just trying to de-escalate the situation. But she said that that behavior aid that was provided her gave her the confidence and the skills and the strategies to deal with a so-called tier three student because she saw it in action and it helped. And this little girl has changed. It may be a little boy too. I don't want to say anything. Okay. But this student has changed. Okay. And she has, it's night and day, and she still has her moments, but the teacher has the skills now, and I was talking to her, and she says, I don't worry about it anymore because I have the strategies and skills. And it was literally 2 weeks, an hour and a half a day, that it just changed the complexion of the classroom. She doesn't have to worry about taking them to the students because she would take them to another classroom. You know, I would go in there, my AP would go in there, our support staff would go in there. And now that doesn't happen at all. So, which, you know, working along this behavior aid helped my teacher attain the strategies and skills to address students who may have these challenging behaviors. So, and I know that's what Mike Tinkup is going to talk about now, is dealing with those challenging behaviors and the next steps for that.
Let me just make one comment on that, that you had said that it was just by accident or by fortune that that person was available because they just had finished another case.
yeah.
And a couple of months ago, we had several elementary school teachers come to our board meeting mm-hmm. to relay stories about Tier 3 students. Mm-hmm. And as a board member, what I'd be curious is, how do you do what you did, the story you just told us, how do we replicate that district-wide so that...
That's a perfect segue. That's a segue right here. That's when they put me before him.
Great setup, David.
You're welcome.
Good evening, board. I'm Mike Tinkup, Director of Special Education, and I'm going to talk a little bit about addressing challenging student behaviors. We have talked at great length for about 2 hours. I think I have, 3 minutes left? about PBIS structures, about SST structures, about discipline, PBIS being a framework, and SSTs being a process by which we address student need. When we get to a point, as Jason was explaining, where we've exhausted a lot of those tiers, tier one, tier two levels, we start to get to tier three. We look at three things. We look at a psychologist team protocol I'm going to talk to you about. We look at behavioral and educational strategies team, which is BEST. And we look at developing a behavior action plan. So we apply this psychologist team protocol to lots of different crises, one of which is a student who becomes quite aggressive, as Jason explained. There's different crises that we will respond to with our psychologists, threat or suicidal, homicidal behavior, aggressive behavior, student or person typically calling the school psychologist. I'm going to talk about if that psychologist is not available on the next slide. I'm going to show you. Psychologist working with your crisis team will assess the situation, give next steps on how to proceed. Really, this was set up to make sure that we supported sites with mental health personnel in a quick manner. Sites aren't available. We set up different site teams. In addition to psychologists being assigned to their high schools or elementary schools, we set Ike's to call if they weren't available. And that's what Dorcas wasn't available. We would move on to, that's the psychologist team protocol. Now, you may have heard this term BEST. So what is BEST? Why did we set up BEST? BEST is a mental health unit, basically, in special education that we set up. With the mission of BEST is to improve student social, emotional, and or behavioral functioning engagement of students district-wide. That's why we set up the team, and I'm going to show you the team in a minute. Basically came up with the idea of let's put together a mental health team that can respond and give a second set or a third set of eyeballs on some of these difficult situations so we can provide some of the supports that Jason was talking about beyond all of the things that we've already tried. So myself, Dr. Trish Carlson, program specialist, she's a clinical psychologist, and then you see them only give a percentage of time to BEST, and then percentages of time to their sites to take care of site needs. Coaches that are educational specialists, that's what Jason was talking about in terms of the gentleman that came in and assisted. So Mr. Malkin, you were kind of asking the question of what's the process by which we access BEST. Right now the process is the school psychologist at the site exhausts approaches through PBIS, approaches through the SST process, creates plans to engage and help with the student's behavior, and when those things are active, then they would submit a referral and significant amount of data and what we term direction. That information is going to be in there. All of the data we need. They do.
They all have
a all sites. Each school?
Yes. But they may go from one elementary school to the other.
Okay.
So what they'll do is gather all that data and complete a BEST referral. The team at BEST, and this is what we designed and we think it's very effective, takes in that information and then deploys a psychologist as well as an education specialist to the site to manage the behavior. So a teacher, and immediately start consultation and interventions, as you heard. Start off with a significant amount of data. Really, I think what it is and what it amounts to is more coaching. You're able to put together a plan. I'll talk about a behavior action plan in a minute. But I think a critical piece in what's effective, what we've seen to that coaching component. building the capacity of that individual teacher or that school site to handle those difficult behaviors when faced with them, be able to coach that staff on that process. That's what we find is quite effective. So when you need a plan, right? Before you start coaching, you have to develop a plan. So when you develop a plan, and I'll get to it in a minute, that plan could be either proactive or reactive, but you need to come up with some kind of plan to engage in. A lot of the proactive services are very similar to Tier 1 and Tier 2, as you see up on the screen. Reactive services, that's kind of where we're looking at moving into Tier 3 interventions. Not Tier 3 kids, by the way, Tier 3 interventions. So you're going to look at individual counseling interventions, targeted group counseling interventions, and implementation of individual. In special education, we have some legal guidelines and requirements where we have to put together what are called behavior intervention plans, which are a little more significant and intense. That's why you see the difference in those behaviors. But for the purposes of BEST would come in and start to implement a behavior action plan. So when you look to develop a behavior action plan, Kevin talked about it earlier with respect to function. You're looking for function of the behavior, right? Why is the student engaging in the behavior that they're engaging in? So we look at that as the ABCs of behavior. What you'll look at are antecedents first. What happened right before the incident? What kind of data did you collect prior to the behavior? And a request made. Was it a difficult task? Was the student asked very closely at those antecedents? The behavior, and this is a little different than identifying the observable behavior like, throwing a chair or tearing up paper. What you look for in this approach is you look at the specific behavioral deficits that the student might have. Throwing a chair, what are they trying to communicate to you? Right? So you try to teach. This is the teaching part. So a student may have a difficult time managing frustration, requesting help. Then consequence, I know we use the term consequence in a negative fashion quite a bit, but in this theory, consequence is simply what happens after the behavior occurs. So what happened? Did the student get an office referral? Did the teacher redirect? Collect data in all these areas to understand function. Once you start looking at function, typically kids want to gain. They're looking to gain something or avoid something. Those are the two most prominent functions of behavior. So again, you look at the ABCs relative to, based on the function, how do you want to tweak those areas and create a plan to help the student? So for example, under the antecedent section, how are you going to remove, if the function is to gain, right? How are you going to remove the triggers for that student so they can engage in a better behavior? So you might do something like create visuals so a student can clearly see expectations for talking. If that student is blurting out in class to gain attention, this would be a strategy you would tweak in the antecedents to help that student function a little bit better in the classroom. If they're trying to avoid something, a student knows a transition is coming up. Students with autism oftentimes struggle with transition. Time is coming up, you put strategies in place to pre-correct that student and let them know that transition is coming. Simple things like that can help you avoid behaviors. So then how are you going to teach your replacement behavior? So you would teach model role play how to get teacher attention. Instead of blurting out in class, how about we raise our hand? And when you raise your hand, the consequence is an endorsement of some sort. Student earns privilege to take a message to the office. And you teach them. So really it's the key to improving behavior is coming up with a good plan and strategies, but it's also that coaching by the team. Questions?
Sounds really easy, but it takes a long time.
Okay.
I have a question. You said you were the last step would be to the referral process, and that's what, how long will it take after they've already done all these things and the interventions that now you have a referral for a behavioralist to come to the classroom and help out, like what happened at Oswald?
How long does it take for them to respond, the team to respond? If it's a serious behavior, they're responding immediately. In fact, I'll be in meetings, I get texts, I'm sending personnel out to respond to situations. Okay. I do that a great deal during the school day.
Thank you very much.
You're
very
welcome.
Informative.
So now we're going to transition to, we've gone through school, through special ed and BEST team, and now what are some of the...
Okay, well, good evening, and I won't take too much time because you all are such active and enthusiastic supporters of the FRC that you know a lot of what we do. But in particular, in the context of behavior support, our community liaisons serve an essential function in truly being a liaison between the parent and the school. Oftentimes, parents will be called in or get a call from the school about a behavior issue that their child is experiencing or a consequence that has been given to their child. And the parents, due to cultural differences, linguistic barriers, just a lack of experience with our formal schooling system, struggle with that and are a little bit intimidated to ask the questions there in the moment, on the phone with the teacher or the administrator, in the principal's office. That's not to say that our schools aren't incredibly responsive and thorough at explaining, but parents sometimes just don't feel comfortable in the moment. And the liaisons can step in when a referral is followed up, and all of our principals have discussed using the FRC in this manner. The liaisons can help make those explanations, and sometimes they're in the home, and the parents are much more comfortable in their own home than in a principal's office. So I find that the liaisons do serve an essential role, and adding our new social worker, Susan Alfaro, who's here tonight, has been a nice layer to that support that the liaisons can provide the schools, because she brings that clinical lens. I have a wonderful 26-year educational background, but I don't know social services to any great depth, yet Susan does. She steps in, and the two of us work on case management with the liaisons and can provide those two lenses to it. And another thing that's been mentioned has been the outside referrals for mental health support. So anyone can submit a referral for school-based mental health support. And that includes administrators, office staff, teachers, parents themselves. Even students can report to an adult that they'd like that help. And we process a lot of mental health referrals. I think you had some data on those numbers pretty recently. And we rely on all members of our educational community to help help eliminate that stigma. Because a lot of our parents are frightened by the process of going through intake, are hesitant to sign consent because they perceive mental health support as stigmatic for them, for their children, for their family. And so it's a message that we continue to convey, that we all need to talk about mental health as a way to help kids get back on track to achieving their goals in school, their best potential, because we know that a good, solid education is their best answer to this cycle of intergenerational poverty. So one of the referrals that we often utilize is that of therapeutic behavior supports, and this is available to students currently in counseling. So counseling is a lower level intervention, but when those behaviors continue to be seen in school, to escalate, we can bring in therapeutic behavior supports, which provides a child specialist coach who serves the student both in school and at home to help with those behaviors. Because if we help with the behaviors in one context and not the other, it's not going to be a comprehensive solution for students in those improvements. Some of the mental health partners we use, these are all DMH providers. Well, the first four are Enki Pacific Clinics, Children's Bureau, and Foothill Family. They will do
mental health services in the school, in the home, in their centers. They're very flexible. They do the intake in flexible places. Today we had a really hard situation at Northam, and the folks came out and did the intake on the spot, and it was quite effective for the situation. We have Masonic Center for Youth and Families, which we send our families who have private insurance yet cannot access those mental health benefits due to high copays, geographic limitations, transportation limitations, maybe a long waiting list for those services. We also utilize 5 Acres for therapeutic behavior supports. They're provided in the first 4 agencies as well, but therapeutic behavior supports at 5 Acres is just another opportunity when maybe the specialists are all dealing with other kids. We just have another agency to refer to. And then, of course, we try our very best to help our parents with private insurance to access those benefits. And we also have intensive behavior supports available to students and families. This is in the form of full-service partnership and can serve students up to age 15. Sorry. It's 24/7 support of a therapist, a parent partner, and a child specialist. Our foster students are streamlined to this when the behavior escalates to the point where this is necessary. And this is after we've tried individual counseling, after we've tried therapeutic behavior supports. When none of that is working, we go to FSP. But it's also available to non-foster students as well. We have a pretty unique opportunity here in Roland that not many districts provide, and that's the Parent Project. And Parent Project is unique in that it meets a court mandate for parenting education. So a judge says, you are running the risk of losing custody of your child. You need to take a court-approved parent class, and we can provide that in the Parent Projects. Parents come to 10 weeks, 3 hours a session. If they miss a session, I don't know if you know Irma Almanza. She's our community liaison who leads this. She's amazing, and she has them make it up, gives them a lot of opportunities, but they don't get off the hook in any way. And they're not so happy, those court-mandated folks, the first night, the second night, but by the third night and certainly by the end, they're very glad to be there, and they report. We have them write, and I love reading what they write throughout the 10 weeks because it just gets better and better. Loving Solutions is the version of Parent Project that's available for elementary age students. We have Morning Break Club at many schools, and then we have a lot of outside agencies who are coming to us and saying they want to provide parenting for our families. So lots of support for parenting education. Problem is, other than the court mandate parents, we don't always get the parents who need it the most. And so that's a challenge that we're always trying to bridge with the liaisons working directly one-on-one with the families. So I will hand it over. Back to Kevin.
I have a question.
Oh, yes.
The mental health partners, what happens when you have a referral and, you know, they're supposed to go to Foothill,
yes,
but the parents won't take them? Now, I don't want them to fall through the cracks. Do we do something else to provide something out at the school level?
Absolutely. Yep, we sure do.
What happens?
We have several different supports in 7 through 12, and at Rorimer, we have Gear Up, Growth, Education, and Resilience, which is a counseling trainee who works under the supervision of our 2 supervisors, soon to add Susan as a 3rd supervisor. And they do not require Medi-Cal, and the intake process is less lengthy. We also have lower tiers of support in the ME program, the Early Mental Health or Primary Intervention Program, the program of many names. We really work on the parents to get them to come in, and our agencies are so flexible about going into the home. But sometimes it can be lengthy, and sometimes families are so in crisis that going to an intake session is not high on their list of priorities. So it's something we're always working on.
Further answer the question, one of the pieces that Laurel and her team have been working really hard on, and I think in all fairness and honesty, that there are, we make referrals, and like Laurel had said, that families in crisis, it may not be their first priority. And so we are still struggling in terms of how do you get the services to the families who need it the most if you don't have even some willingness on the part of the family to engage. Because we cannot provide services unless there's at least permission. So if there's permission, we can do it in many of the ways that Laurel has mentioned. And that's where our community liaisons also come into place, because they can go out to the home, sit at the kitchen table and have a conversation and have the parent sign the permission slip that we can provide services. But absence of that, it's challenging.
I have a question for Laurel. On under your full service partnerships, under intensive behavioral supports,
yes.
I notice that goes up to age 15. What about a 16 or a 17-year-old?
That is just not covered under it. It's developed in a child and adolescent framework that goes up to age 15 developmentally and just isn't appropriate for 16, 17, 18-year-olds. So
so they're just adolescent?
It just becomes a trickier situation usually. Sometimes there's a probation officer involved, honestly, and there, through probation, there are a lot of interventions available to our students.
At a CSBA conference, I went to a workshop on family resource services, and this is done in San Diego, I think it is. They do this in high school, intermediate school and high school. They give all the students at the beginning of the year a little card to put in their wallet. And it says, if you're feeling depressed, if you're feeling, you know, you want to hurt yourself, if you need help, and it has contact numbers to call 24/7. I thought that was a good idea, because a lot of times the students need the service after hours.
Sure.
And this will give them a phone number they can call, whether it be an outside agency or wherever.
Absolutely.
The new law that we're going to
yes,
have.
Yes, there is
our
a new
students.
Law. Yeah.
Starting in the fall with mm-hmm. our students on the back of
pardon?
Autism.
Autism.
I'm going to let.
Is autism considered mental health?
Mental health.
It's a diagnostic condition that looks at a developmental disability, but certainly students with autism could develop mental health issues. So you just look at it case by case. Higher functioning students with autism, for instance, that may not have a lot of friendships, may not engage in a lot of relationships, as they develop and get older, they might start to think about that a little bit more and develop some, not necessarily under mental health, but it could be associated with it.
And will accept the fact or reject the...
When we seek consent from parents, we talk about the fact that this intervention will help their children do well in school, because that is our business, is getting kids to achieve their best potential in school. And counseling is a very important aspect of that. So when we frame it in the context of taking advantage of this assistance and this help will result in your student, will likely result in your student doing better in school.
How does a teacher get access to this form, this school-based mental health services referral form?
Sure. So that form is available. Every school in their front office has an FRC binder that has all our referral forms that they're welcome to grab and copy. That's kind of the old school access. We also have a Google folder that has all the FRC referral forms in it. It has information about our food distributions, the parent project. It has, for the high schools, it has information on partial credit and reduced credit graduation. And everyone has access to that shared folder.
Okay, because this came up for discussion a while back, and the impression I was getting is some teachers weren't aware that this form was available.
Okay, so I've been making my way around to all the schools at a staff meeting and showing them the binder. Good. And making sure that the folder's shared with them and just going through ways that they can best support their students with in foster care or in experiencing homelessness and extreme poverty. And we depend on teachers and counselors to help us identify the kids, because mm-hmm. we under-identify
we're always finding kids whose parents didn't want to divulge their living circumstances. So it's a nice back and forth to be able to, for me to go out to all the school sites and talk about FRC services, talk about the unique needs of students in extreme poverty and ways that teachers can engage them. And we can kind of mutually support each other's work.
And then in the elementary schools, when a student is referred, at what point does he get evaluated to see if he's a special needs student rather than just a behavioral, disruptive student?
The law states that when you start to suspect a disability, there's 13 disabilities. So when you start to suspect a disability, you have enough evidence or enough data that one of the 13 disabilities may exist, you conduct an assessment to take a look at whether it exists or not. When you're dealing with students who become severely depressed, high levels of anxiety, and you have that documented with intervention, but the depressed continues to have high levels of anxiety, then you would start looking at a category called emotional disturbance. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you would do an assessment. And if they meet criteria for emotional disturbance, then you would afford them special education services.
So after a great presentation on student behavior and discipline practices and procedures, our next slide talks about next steps and recommendations. And part of our continued efforts are to provide intervention training for targeted audiences. So these are self-identified site administrators and teachers who call upon us to provide them with specific training around specific behaviors that they're dealing with on a day-to-day basis, very unique to their situation. And we want to do that because, as we know, not all behaviors are displayed in the same way or at the same time. Like we talked about earlier, sometimes they are displayed in kindergarten. Sometimes we don't see them till they're in third or fourth grade. We also want to fine-tune and share the support team contacts and protocols. So Mike shared how the phone tree has been provided to site administrators about who to call when they have a crisis. What we want to do is continue to expand on that phone tree and add who on their staff is CPI trained, who has received training on threat assessment, and who is a behavior specialist that they can contact in times of need. We want to expand the supports of Tier 3. We know that one cohort of schools has gone through complete training of PBIS, which includes Tier 3. This year, we have the second cohort that will complete that training. And next year, all of our schools will have gone through the entire training of PBIS, which includes Tier 3 supports. We know that that's an area that we need to continue to focus on and continue to research resources on how do we do this for our sites on an ongoing basis. We want to increase the number of staff who are CPI trained, including administrators. So we have provided some trainings this school year. We provided a training over the winter break. We provided a training in February, and I believe there's one set for April. Mm-hmm. So we are expanding on that. Expansion of behavior specialists, behavior aides, behavior support. The recommendation is that we add staff to the best team to ensure that the best team is not only servicing special ed, but now expands to general education. So that will come forth through our superintendent to the board so that we can add a cohort of folks that are now district-wide and not just special education, but everybody can call upon them for assistance. School counselor support in social, emotional, and academic needs of students. So most of our counselors do a great job in balancing the support they give students, not only in academics, but also social, emotional. And we want to make sure that every counselor has what they need so that they can support both sides of providing support to a student as they need. Updating and calibrating the student study team process. What we find typically is that after years of implementation, a system needs to be recalibrated. We need to make sure that everybody's using the same language, has the same understandings, and is also using the same formats. And right now, we could say that we we have varieties of student success teams. So we want to calibrate it and train our schools, all 19 schools, and make sure we're on the same page. Coaching and monitoring of behavior plans. This is a responsibility definitely of the site, of the district level office, and also we're looking to have the best team support us in making sure that those plans are actually reaching our students' needs, and if not, how do we modify to make sure that their behavior is changing? And lastly, we want to make sure that our language is universal and common. There's so many different ways that we talk about behavior plans. Mike talked about the behavior plan that is specific to special ed, and then there's a BAP, and there's so many different acronyms for what we do that we're always asking, what does that mean? And so part of a strong systemic approach to what we do is making sure that the language is across the board and that we're all saying the same thing, whether you're at Blandford or at Villacorta, whether you're at Nogales or you're at Roland High School. And that will provide us with a strong common understanding amongst not only our administrators, our support staff, but also our teachers and our aides and our classified staff. Everybody that reaches a child's life should have the same language. These are some of our next steps and recommendations for this year and next year.
David? I have a question. And maybe Shay can help us out on this. That we had, you know, a number of teachers that spoke to the board a couple of months ago, and then I personally received quite a number of letters after that board meeting regarding incidences and concerns they had. I would love it, if possible, if we had the names of those teachers that presented and the ones that sent the letters, that we could send them the next steps so they know that we took their concerns seriously and that we plan on, they took the time out to write us a letter.
I think that might be something if we could ask Shay if he could relay that as well. And I think that it's also noted that some of the principals of the schools that were represented are here tonight to be able to share, and they have been in constant communication with the teachers. And the board has received that feedback as the principals have gone back to get better understanding mm-hmm. of what's happening at the local school site. So does that, would that suffice?
I just want to make sure that you get some feedback.
Yeah.
Know that they took time to write us a letter, and I think they deserve a response.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm going to go back to my way back when question. Okay, a teacher sends a student to the office. How does the teacher notify the office the student is coming? Do they phone the office? And who interacts with the student first when they get to the office? And how can we be assured that the teacher is getting feedback from the office principal or whoever once a student has been sent? Does that make sense? Basic stuff. Sorry, but
right, no problem.
We need it all.
So usually, if it's referred to the office, right? If it's a major, you know, the minors are usually addressed in the classroom. Majors are referred to the office. Usually, you know, they have a referral form, and the student will walk to the office. Now, if it's a student that, you know, we worry that may not get to the office, you know, then they'll call. But most of the students, they're close campuses, not very far to go, so they go to the office. And it, you know, it depends on who sees them first. If the vice principal or principal are there, of course, they're the one that address it. Usually, they'll walk into the office, and one of the ladies in the front office, or gentleman, will, you know, see the referral and then let the administrator know. And sometimes they're seen right away. Sometimes there's multiple kids in the office at once. You might have five kids at once, especially during lunchtime, right, when the behaviors tend to happen. You know, disagreements over basketball games. It could be, you know, name-calling, those kind of things. And so those are, you know, dealt with in proper order. And then, and that's one of the things that we're talking about this time is norming the process. You know, Mr. Garcia said one of the things that was implemented is an automatic email that goes to the teacher saying, this is what was done, A, B, C. Because, again, sometimes teachers will feel they didn't get the response they wanted because the kid's back in their class
all right, but we know that there are limitations on what, you know, the what tools we have at disposal. But we want to make sure that we communicate with the teachers on this is what done. So that is part of the process, is making sure that we norm ourselves in how we respond to teachers when these referrals are made, particularly the major referrals.
Is that a protocol that each school sets their own? Because the complaint I was hearing was, I've sent this kid to the, this is more high school. I sent the kid to the office, kid come back, and I never hear anything. Nothing happened. That's what's being reported. So I just hope there is a system implemented in each and every school so that it's, and it doesn't have to be throughout the district, but it should be consistent within your school.
Yeah.
And that teachers should have some reassurance that somebody's paying attention to the fact they're sending that student. They're not just blowing you off
right.
for sending a student to the office.
And that's something Maddie can share, our principals, too. And we've addressed it in our principals' meetings to make sure that that communication does go back. And some do it on form. You noticed on the major minor forms, there's a response part, and that goes back to the teacher. Some is done by email. Some make personal contact. So it is site-based. So it's not district-wide, this is the protocol. It is individually done at each school site. But your point is well taken. It should be consistent on each school site.
Could you review that at your next principals meeting, maybe, to make sure that they're aware of the board's concern?
Wednesday.
She wanted to say something.
It's a minor, and the teacher takes care of what was done, and it's called a parent, meet with the parent, so they take care of that. But when there's a parent and walk the student, or I also have a TOSA also that's very well versed and teams good work with us, so just there to support.
The school counselors, are you adding social and emotional to their workload, additional to the current Muslim academic?
It's actually part of what they do now, but we want to make sure that they have barriers removed that allows them to take that on maybe a little bit more. So we want to look at what's currently happening and how we can support them so that it's consistently part of their day-to-day work. So it is currently part of their work.
My concern is my understanding that their workload is pretty heavy right now for helping the kids' academic part. If we're adding more and the social and emotional to that, to additional to...
I think, that on some of these, I think... If we're going to really look at the system, mm-hmm. we might have to repurpose some of the duties and functions of some people in order to implement these next steps. And that can be everything from repurposing what they're doing to adding additional staff, I don't know, and what that would cost. And that all has to be figured out. But I know when I speak to the counselors, their graduation requirements, at least in the high school, mm-hmm. is the primary thing to make sure that they're meeting the graduation requirements and their college entrance, exams and everything. And like Mr. Chen's saying, a lot of them say they're not trained in mental health. They're trained in, school counseling, more towards getting, getting graduated and getting into college. So that's why I was so happy that we brought a social worker on that can do counseling, clinical counseling. I don't know. Maybe we need additional social workers in the schools. I don't know.
I think, our intent is to look at their job description and look at and see how they're spending their time and how might we repurpose some of the things that they're doing. It is, however, part of their job description. And I know that perhaps maybe training might be important and we might need to bring that in. So I believe that that's part of our intent, is to look at what they're currently doing. But it's not necessarily to burden them anymore. It's to look at their day-to-day and how that looks, so that we can assist.
Yes, I was going to mention the high school teachers. That's who you're going to be training to, as well as other counselors, as far as to get them to be more social and emotional help with that, with the students, the high school counselors.
It's all of our counselors,
okay.
Yes.
And then expansion of behavior specialists, behavior aides, that means we're going to hire more?
Well, that is a recommendation that's going to be coming through our superintendent to add to the team. And we may need to expand the term of the best team so that we have more people to call upon. And they all respond to both special ed and general education needs.
That's yes. great that we're doing
today. That is a recommendation.
And with the recommendation, will that be about like one per two schools? Or depending on population, do we know what that recommendation is yet?
We're looking at that right now. We definitely will not be recommending one per school. That's not what we're looking at.
Per two schools, I think.
But
not one per two schools?
No. The recommendation is really needing to be strategic so that we are not overstaffed, but also we're not at a deficit.
Okay, before I close the meeting, I just want to say on behalf of the board, thank you so much for your thorough report, the principal sharing what you do at your school. It was very interesting, and it's good, very good information for all of us, everybody. Thank you so much. What else did I want to say?
Okay. It was very thorough.
Glad that you did this. Thank you. Okay, and sorry that it took so long, but very informative. Okay, can I please have a motion and a second to adjourn the board study session of the Rowland Unified School District Board of Education?
I move.
I'll second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Meeting adjourned at 7:12 p.m.